Yeah, so I wanted to share tonight is sort of a set of paradoxes about how to face death, how to work with it. And this is, I will say, this is a certain amount of my own journey here. It's a little bit on the personal side because of this is something I've been, this is really, I in a sense, back when I started on the spiritual path, in a sense, when I was like 8 years old.
She's sending this to both of us.
I was very aware of death. It's just like I knew, oh my God, I'm going to die. What do you do? How do you hold that? And it was a lot of what drove me onto the spiritual path was wanting answers, wanting to hold this, the seriousness of that situation and not just skate through and then die. It seemed like it was too important to ignore. So in our house, which is now east of Woodinville, but it was in Kirkland for 30 years, I've got it's called an evening gatha from Zen tradition that I've had on the wall the entire time. And it reminds me, it says, let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. Let us strive to awaken, awaken. Take heed, do not squander your life. And that's something, if you can look up evening gatha, that's something that I just bring into my heart all the time in terms of not wasting time, you know? Like some of you, I am now a white-haired person or an older person, and it gets more pressing, but it's always pressing. People die, you know, in a minute. That's called an accident, when people suddenly die. So we're all prone to that. Now there's a way in which, and was interesting is there's a way in which that's kind of gone, you know? It's powerful, but it's also kind of gone, like this possibility that you have to, we're called to step into, to awaken, even though, speaking for myself, we haven't done that yet. Or maybe there's tastes that some of us have, but it's a journey toward that which is still far away, and yet we're called to go in that direction. So, very interesting. And let me ask, how many people saw Eben Alexander? I know I put an email out about it. Quite a few. Okay. So, very interesting world that's happening more and more in the 21st century, partly because of medical technology and other things, I think, where there's a lot of interesting evidence floating around about continuity of consciousness after the death of a body. Eben Alexander, he's a former neurosurgeon from Harvard, had meningitis, cerebral meningitis, something, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, and he was in a coma for, I think, 7 days, something like that. Heart, his EEG, is that right, was flatlined a good part of the time. And he had this amazing near-death experience, which he came back and has written multiple books since then. I actually had a chance to interview him myself. Clear Mountain interviewed him several years ago. He was just a delight. And I've met several other, there's one of the oldest chapters of there is an organization, the International Association of Near-Death Studies, which is a global organization. One of the oldest chapters is in the Seattle area. And the woman who runs it, Kimberly Clark, she's really cool. I like her a lot. And she had an NDE back when she was very young in Kansas, which is part of why she ended up in Seattle. And I've gotten to know her a little bit, and she totally has her oars in the water. She was head of social work for Harborview for 20 years. And as I said to her, you got to have your oars in the water to do that. And she said, oh yeah. So very together person who had an NDE. So how do we think about that in terms of this journey, this Dharma journey? Because it's pretty fascinating. Now, what Eben talked about, what he kind of offered, was this sense of this all-knowing higher power suffusing the energy, the universe with love. I mean, it's wonderful. I'm not saying it's wrong. I don't know. But it was, it's beautiful stuff. And it's worth letting into our hearts as we journey this journey. And he's totally convinced that awareness continues after death. I mean, he's sort of done the flip where this is just a temporary sojourn in this body and it continues, which to be sure, is how Buddhists look at it also. So kind of the flavor is a little different, but the framework is in many ways the same. You can get down in the weeds about what it means, if that's a heaven realm is in or this or that. It really doesn't matter, I don't think. What matters is how we navigate this question of our body and how we navigate our Dharma journey, you know, the spiritual journey we're on in the context of death. And, you know, Eben's vision, it's kind of nice, and it's kind of like our, you know, and some of you may be Christian also, if I say anything that offends anyone. I don't mean to, because I'm not, you know, the hope for me, personally, when I was a kid, the whole, like, the monotheistic, have faith thing just absolutely didn't work for me. I couldn't believe in something that wasn't proven. I was refused. And I felt like that people were doing it to be comfortable. Quite frankly, it's how it felt to me. I have no judgments. That's just how it felt to me. So I went to church a bunch of times and kept leaving. I mean, I was looking for something, but that just wasn't it. This believe in stuff. Which is part of what's so wonderful about the Dharma, because the Buddha said specifically in the Kalama Sutta, he said, you know, don't do anything because anyone says it, because they're charismatic, because it's in a book, because I say it, you got to see it yourself. And that's what's so powerful about the Dharma. So in this question of life and death, and what we are and how we continue or not, we got to see it ourselves. And how we work with that has a lot to do with how, especially your older folks, but anyone who's awake, how we navigate our Dharma journey in the coming years or coming months, or it might be coming days. You never know. I always hold it like it might be days, because otherwise I feel like I'm on cruise control. So, you know, if a view like you requires faith, then it's maybe for many of us, we want proof, we want experience. That's why we practice. That's why this is a journey of Dharma practice. So in terms of rebirth, you know, how do we work with that? Do we believe in rebirth? Some people believe in rebirth. Do we just practice for this lifetime with a sense that there's no rebirth? I know a lot of Dharma practitioners are pretty much, they're either agnostic or pretty much don't think there's any rebirth, but they're very serious practitioners. And they feel like it's the best thing I can imagine doing in the time I got, is to change and grow and become clearer and more mindful in the moment and more loving, more loving kindness, and just grow in that way. So a lot of people who absolutely don't believe in rebirth are practicing with great vigor. But if there is rebirth, that adds a new wrinkle to it, to how we navigate it. And it turns out the Buddha is surprisingly flexible on this point about how we navigate this. And there's several places, but the Majjhima Nikaya 60, he said, about this question of rebirth or not, he said, about this, a wise man considers thus, if there is another world, then on this dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no other world. Still, this good person is here and now praised by the wise as a virtuous person, one with right view, who holds the doctrine of affirmation. And on the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person has made a lucky throw on both counts. Isn't that great? A lucky throw on both counts, since he's praised by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. So this is kind of hilarious win-win. And I think it's really funny that the Buddha specifically said that, because he's not trying to convince people. There's rebirth. Talks about it a lot, but he's not trying to convince it. He's not saying you have to believe this. So he's saying it works either way. The journey works either way. So that's great. But if there is rebirth, then our practice takes on a whole new realm, because whatever we're accomplishing this lifetime, we can continue. And that's worth considering. Because as we practice and start to see the possibility of awakening and what that might mean, it'd be a shame not to be able to do that if, because of our conditions or life conditions or our issues, whatever, we only are going so far, but we have this sense of what's possible, then the possibility of many lifetimes is pretty engaging and kind of hopeful, kind of enlivening. But if that's the case, if there are many lifetimes, then why is the Zen Gatha so urgent? Saying time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. Let us strive to awaken, awaken. Take heed, do not squander your life. Because you'd think if we have infinitely many lifetimes, we could just kind of cruise and enjoy the sun, and we got more and more and more, so what's the problem? And we'll talk about the likelihood of rebirth in a minute, but if there is rebirth, there's some reasons to feel urgent about how we conduct our lives this time around. And, you know, it's funny because most of us don't remember our prior lifetimes, so we're not going to remember this lifetime next time around, most of us. Some of us might, I don't know. So in one sense, there's not a sense of continuity. We don't remember who we were. And in any case, we were probably so different. I mean, inherently we were so different, we wouldn't even recognize ourselves. And we wouldn't even recognize ourselves if we were 12 years old, probably, in terms of we've become so different. So there's this funny disconnect in that way. But from a Buddhist point of view, some of the reasons to be really careful about how we negotiate this question of rebirth is, from Buddhist cosmology point of view, there's a lot of problematic areas we could get into. From a Buddhist cosmology point of view, there are six realms. There's human, hungry ghosts, hell realms, and then animal realms, and asuras, which are warring gods, and devas, which are god realms. So there's this whole complex Buddhist cosmology. It's in all the traditions. And, you know, I don't necessarily believe in it, but it's worth paying attention to, because from that point of view, you know, if we did lots of negative things, we might not end up human again. We might end up in some realm that would be problematic. So that's worth considering, bringing into the package. It's getting close into the area of faith, I get that. But nonetheless, worth paying attention to, because it's really consistent. Oddly consistent. I mean, I've been in Tibetan tradition a lot, Theravada tradition, it's exactly the same, the Buddhist cosmology. It didn't change across traditions. And I won't even go into the hell realms, but they're just as nasty as the Christian ones. And it's not like you get thrown somewhere, it's like what your state of mind is. You know, if you have a really state of mind, negative state of mind, and you're not in a body, you're just going to be in that negative state of mind, which is essentially a hell realm. So that, point being, if there is rebirth, or even if we don't know there's rebirth, it's something to encourage us to grow on the path. And then one thing I think about a lot, and Susan, you brought it up, in terms of climate change, and in terms of, just say we are reborn 100 years from now. It could be really rough. I mean, 100 years from now could be really tough. And if you were born in Yemen tomorrow, it could be really tough. So it's really worth, I mean, in all seriousness, if we are embracing the possibility of rebirth, it's really important to me, that's a big, this may sound odd, but for me, that is part of what makes me sort of pedal to the metal about my own growth. A, because I want to have the depth, enough depth and equanimity to be able to handle that. Really difficult. And B, because I like to be there for people, you know, to have enough equanimity and love so in the middle of chaos, we can benefit others. So, it's pretty interesting. So the What the Buddha offered in terms of the path to Nibbana is a freedom of not clinging that transcends conditions, is not dependent on conditions. And as we awaken on the journey into freedom, there's happiness. There's equanimity and peace no matter the conditions. You know, as we talked about in other times, the Buddha actually, his lifetime was very difficult. The circumstances around him, you might think it was all kind of peace and light. It wasn't. I mean, he had two major benefactors who were both kings, both of whom were deposed by their sons, and both of whom died during the Buddha's lifetime. So it was complete political chaos. He had one of his cousins, Devadatta, multiple times trying to kill him and usurp him and push him out of his role. All kinds of difficulties. And plus he had a bad back and headaches and stone splinter in his foot. So, point being that this journey to awakening, it helps us in difficult conditions in a former life, in a next lifetime if there is one. And so in terms of that urgency, which is why I was talking about this particular facet, you can see why, even if there is multiple lifetimes, that urgency that Gatha is talking about is real. You know, there's really something to work with. And also, you know, the access that we have to the Dharma here in the 21st century is remarkable. And we don't know what it's going to be like 100 years from now. I mean, it's, you know, all the stuff's on the internet. There's great teachers around. We don't know what it's going to be like. So this, to be able to just use what we've learned, to me, that's, you know, I've had the great opportunity to be around some great teachers and still am. Clear Mountain and Tim Guile's very good and a lot of good people. You know, to just really work with it is precious. It's precious. So it's kind of a win-win. You know? If the reality is that we only have this one lifetime, there'll be some discernible fruit that we can see from our track. We'll be kinder to our loved ones. We'll be kinder to ourselves. We'll just be happier. And if there are future lifetimes, then we're doing the absolute best thing we could be doing to align ourselves to move forward into those. So the possibility of rebirth is a game changer. And part of what's fascinating about all this is here in 2024, here in the early 21st century, there's some evidence happening about rebirth that really wasn't around just 15, 20 years ago. I mean, it's kind of a more important. I'll say one more thing before I get to that, because I forgot that I was going to say it. Is an important term to remember. Did anyone hear Ajahn Jayasaro when he was here? He was, yeah. He said one thing that really struck me, and I went back and did some research to refresh myself, make sure I got it right. There's a concept in the Dharma. There are different levels of attainment that are articulated in Theravada tradition, and one's called a stream enterer. It's kind of when you enter the stream of the spiritual journey. And the way he said, that's 99% of Nibbana, he said. And it's also, he said, this is accessible for folks like us to do that shift into stream entry. And there's three requirements or thresholds, and they're very powerful. One is, it's eliminating or turning back three things. One is a belief or a conviction in a permanent, unchanging self. You know, the more we practice, the more we cultivate our mindfulness, the more we see all the component parts of that which we thought was self kind of arise and pass and fall apart, and we start to realize there's no strict person here. As that happens, that's one of the requirements for stream entry, is that we get through that. That we really start to see through this idea of a permanent self. And the second thing to let go of is basically, here it's a phrase I look online, skepticism about the Buddha and the Dharma, but it's really like seeing that the Dharma is true. I mean, it's pretty obvious the Dharma is true. It's just describing the nature of things. It's not like he made up anything. He just saw what he saw and described it. So being convinced of that and letting go of attachment to rites and rituals, which is all that sticky stuff that people do, this kind of, you know, faith-based in the unconscious way. So those are the three requirements of stream entry. So, you know, in a certain sense, I mean, I know a number of you quite well in terms of your practice, and you're, you know, you're doing it. I mean, a lot of people here that have some real recognition of not self, that have a clear conviction about how clear the Dharma is, and they aren't attached to rites and rituals at all. I say that because it actually is encouraging. You know, you're doing pretty good. A whole bunch of you are doing pretty good. And for those of you going to wonder what he's talking about, it's not that far away to do the work that really changes us, and we have this kind of momentum. So it's a fundamental corner. And this sounds a little didactic, but supposedly, according to the Buddha, if you've become a streaming enter, you're guaranteed enlightenment within 7 lifetimes, and you won't be born in a lower realm, assuming you keep your ethics clean. So take that as you will, but I think it's kind of cool. 7 lifetimes and won't be born in a lower realm. No thanks, hell realm. So, and you know that the, well, I'm just not going to get into it, but the 3 characteristics, we've talked about that a lot over the years here, anatta, impermanence, anicca, not self, and I think I got that backwards. Anatta, not self, anicca, impermanence, and dukkha, to see through those, to see the 3 characteristics is part of what brings us freedom in this lifetime. So it's, we can do this. We can do this. And there's a real confidence in the Dharma. So, it's worthwhile if there's no rebirth, but having a sense of the possibility of rebirth can amplify or energize our journey. And this is something, in my own quirky way, I've been interested in for many years. And so I've sort of been involved in some oddball things over the decades. And by the way, some of you know I used to be a journalist. So it's called, in journalism, when you're working on a story, it's called gathering string. In a newsroom, when someone's working on a story, they're gathering string, which means they're pulling in facts and possibilities and seeing how it goes. And in a newsroom, a lot of times you tell the editor, well, here's, I'm doing the story on this. And then you're working on it and you start to realize, you know what? It's not that. It's this. And you go back and say, you know what? It's going this way. And it'll, you know, challenge you, but that's how it works in journalism. So you're gathering string, you're gathering facts, and then you're seeing where it goes. And that's kind of how I look at this whole thing. So there's several areas that are very interesting in terms of this whole question of if there's continuity of awareness when the body dies. One is the whole NDE world. Like I said, there's research happening. I mean, there's a friend of mine, Marjorie Willicott. She also got interviewed, by the way, at Clear Mountain. You might check it out if you're interested. Used to be a tenured professor of neuroscience at the University of Oregon. She's now the research director for IANS. I mean, completely credentialed neuroscientist who's a research director for IANS, very interested in all this stuff. So the whole NDE world is powerful. There's like lots and lots of people who are dying and seeing very parallel kinds of sense of energy and light and stuff out there and coming back, and you can't ignore that. That's sort of my point. As a journalist, you can see stuff, you can't ignore it. And then there's a whole other realm of young people in particular remembering former lifetimes. University of Virginia, they've done, there's been Multa's great book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, which is dry as a bone. And that's part of its appeal, is these young people who completely remember a former lifetime, like as soon as they can talk, and they can come up with all these details, and you check it out and it checks out true. They've done a lot of work for decades at the University of Virginia on that. What do you do with that, right? And then the whole question of out-of-body experiences. I mean, to me, almost that's, and there's a bunch of them, even the woman I was talking about, head of Seattle IANS, Kimberly Clark, when she was a social worker, there's this great story in her book, which I'll share now because it's so wild, that she spoke Spanish as well as English, and a woman landed in the hospital who was a migrant worker from Yakima who had never been in Seattle before in her life, who couldn't speak any English at all, and she had some big accident and died. And then she came back. You know, they revived her. And she was completely hysterical, like in talking in Spanish. She needed to talk to someone about, and so finally they got pulled in. Or my friend, And the woman in Spanish told her that she'd been out of her body. She was floating up above Harborview Hospital. She could see. She'd never been to Seattle, so she was describing somewhere she'd never been on the outside of. And she said, "And there's a blue sneaker up on the ledge up there." And she said, Kimberly said, "What?" She said, "Then you gotta get the sneaker. There's a blue sneaker out there on the ledge, up there on the fifth floor." And Marjorie, Kimberly at that point didn't remember her own NDE. So she was pretty dubious, but she finally, because the woman was just hysterical, said, okay, I'll look. And she had master keys. So she went up and she's up there on the top floor. And the woman described it as a blue sneaker. It had a tear. It had a white lace. It was sitting on a ledge. She goes up there. There it is. And she brings it back. And she says, "Yep, that's it." So what do? You know, I mean, a lot of those things happen. They're anecdotal, to be sure, but. And then there's a lot of the practitioners remembering former lifetimes, as the Buddha did, but many other people do too. Point being, you know, you can't ignore that stuff. I'm just scrolling through this because I already said all the thing I was going to say. You can't ignore that stuff. And even if, you know, one instance of someone being out of their body and aware is true, it just changes everything. Because people think all we are is a bunch of chemicals. You know, it's kind of like the way in which we're afraid we're going to be replaced by AI. But all it is a bunch of machinery. And if we think all we are is a bunch of chemicals, then we got a problem. This is very funny. But I've edited a bunch of Dharma books, and in, when was it? 2018, I think. No, maybe. 2018, I got invited to a conference in Thailand about Buddhism and AI it was 1,000 young Chinese people wearing pink polo shirts and about 3 Westerners, because it was organized by Kempo Sotarje Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan Lama who teaches Han Chinese. It's all very interesting. But they had a bunch of experts from the UK and stuff about AIs long before things really blew up like they are now. And the one thing I remember is Dzongtsar Rinpoche, who's an Nyingma master, he was the one thing that stuck out about the whole thing. And he said, AI is not going to rebirth. There's no rebirth. There's no Buddha nature. There's no awareness there. It's just a bunch of stuff happening, you know, with binary code in a machine. So if there is this possibility, if there is any instance, and I think, to me, as a journalist, former journalist, you can't ignore it. I mean, to me, it's like, it tips me. I've tipped into the arena of rebirth because of all this evidence. I give up. You know, it's like pointing in that direction. I mean, I'm not saying I know, because I don't know. I'll know when I die. But I practice as if it's true. It's been a huge shift for me since I was a kid, when there was no evidence. And now there is. And someone like Eben Alexander, what are you going to say? It's extraordinary. So, I think this changes things. You know, I think when the Buddha said, yes, if you just practice for this lifetime and that's all it is, you'll be good. But if we do know that there's multiple lifetimes, if we do know there's continuity, then it really gives us a sense of this journey we're on. You know, here we are, all of us are lay people, we're not monastics, we're doing the best we can, we have complicated lives. Sometimes you feel like, oh my God, how much am I really getting done on my spiritual journey? But it's worth it. And it is changing. And there's a chance in the future. And it's building on a slow continuum. And I think the mere fact that you're even here, I mean, you could be out gallivanting on the water. It's a beautiful day. What are you doing in this room right now? Why are you not sailing or something? You know, you chose, because there's something in the different people here. You're looking inwardly. You're doing the journey. So you're already way further ahead than you may know or suspect or acknowledge. I guess one other thing I wanted to share, and then I'll be done, is there's a way in which this, all of this, and especially starting to see not self, or starting to see through sticky self, transforms what proximity to death really means for us as individuals. And I have actually some experience with this. So on a very personal level, I haven't died, but some of you know, I've got a heart condition. I got two stents in my heart. And about 4 years ago, before I had the two stents, it was, even though I have a pristine lifestyle, but got bad genes, it was pretty gnarly. I mean, I couldn't walk the length of this church without angina just stopping me dead. I mean, it was intense. And, it took a while to go through the whole angiogram and convince myself that I actually needed to have stents in. But what was interesting for me was, to my surprise, actually, I felt relatively sanguine about the whole thing. I mean, I didn't want to die, and I was doing all kinds of, very positive, coherent efforts to not die, and here I am so far. But nonetheless, the whole prospect of Steve going away didn't bother me nearly as much as I thought it was going to. I was like, okay. And I've looked into it a lot, and I think it's relevant for all of us. I have a feeling this is probably the case for different people. In fact, I know from just some of the deep conversations I've had with some of you. Like, when we practice, when we're doing mindfulness practice in particular, part of why mindfulness practice is so incredible is that we're aware of all these different aspects coming and going, arising and passing. And many of them are essentially like the mosaic of selfhood, our memories, our regrets, our ambitions, our visions, the colors of our heart, all this stuff, and it comes and goes and comes and goes. And over time, it starts to just we start to see it's just a mosaic. There's no one underneath all that. There's no Steve there, ultimately. There's a conventional Steve, I got it. But there's no ultimate Steve. It becomes more and more apparent and less sticky. And of course, I could just be flapping my gums about that, but when I was right up against the possibility I might die at any moment, it was like, oh, I'll be darned. I'm not okay with that exactly, but I'm not freaked out by it either. I was like, okay. It was almost like, because I've already in practice, and a lot of times people say you sort of die to yourself thousands of times in practice. You keep seeing chunks of yourself, all your sticky bits come up and they go away and you see through them and you're slowly like letting go of your whole web of stickiness. When people are like, what do you call it? This is sexist, I'm sorry, drama queen or drama king, but whenever you're sort of really enwrapped, when people are really enwrapped in neuroses and really believe in it and defend it at all costs and that kind of sticky, that sort of practice takes us in the opposite direction. And it gets freer and freer. And the other thing I saw that was really surprising to me was that in the course of practice, we start to rest in awareness more. There's just like a gradual shift where we're more just resting in awareness. The personal stuff doesn't matter so much. Just the fact that there is awareness. And what becomes clearer is this isn't my awareness. There is awareness. I mean, everybody here is aware. And so it became clearer that if Steve died, awareness was going to continue. I mean, there's plenty of beings in this world system and probably world systems throughout the universe. Awareness was going to continue. So it was kind of much more okay than I thought it was going to be. It didn't feel lonely or stark or anything. It was like, oh, okay, awareness will continue. Good. So I offer that because we're talking about death and everything and how that... It sort of interfaces with the whole question of rebirth, because what is it, Lots of places you could get sucked down the weeds, and I don't want to, but just if there is continuity of consciousness, that means there's something that continues. Is that awareness? I won't get too far there right now. But just maybe. Just possibly. Just likely we continue through multiple lifetimes, and that there is a possibility of awakening. So, time swiftly passes by, an opportunity is lost. Let us strive to awaken. Awaken. Take heed. Do not squander your life. Let's just sit for a moment.